All right, joining us now is Richard Sachs. You can find him at lostartsradio.com. And I reached out to Richard. I talked to him several years ago. And I reached out to him because I knew that he was about alternative medicine and other issues. And it made me think about it because of the piece that was out by Michael Snyder saying, if your life is depending on some of these pharmaceuticals, almost all of them now coming from China, you need to start stockpiling these because over 90% of the antibiotics and things like that are coming from China. So if you're dependent on this, you might want to start stockpiling these drugs. And I thought about that when I read it, and I said, well, maybe, you know, you might want to start thinking about other alternatives to these drugs, maybe things that you can do naturally. And so Richard, among many interests that he has, is organic horticulture. And so I wanted to get him on to talk primarily about that. But of course, there's a lot of different things we can talk about in terms of medicine and other things. Thank you for joining us, Richard.
Yeah, it's really a treat to be on, David. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Tell us, first of all, how you got into the health concerns and things like that. You were working with your dad, is that correct?
Yeah, but the way I really got involved was with health-related things is like many of the natural healing teachers have it is I got really sick and I was in very serious health condition in the early 1960s. And wow. I was in the hands of very well-meaning doctors, standard of care medicine, the usual drugs and surgery approach. And I realized for some reason, I was fortunate to realize that they were going to kill my physical body if I continued with this high level care. And I dumped the whole thing. And I decided either I'm going to figure out, you know, what's really going on with health and disease and how things like that work, or I'm at least going to die peacefully without poisonous chemicals that they call medicine.
Yeah.
And I've never been back.
Oh, that's great.
So that was my motivation to learn.
You mentioned, like a lot of people in the health industry, that's the beginning of their journey, the fact that they themselves got very sick. And I have heard that story over and over again. I mean, it's like the person who gets wrongfully convicted and they start studying law books and they become an excellent lawyer. I mean, you know, when you're up against the wall like that and you have to do something and what they're doing to you is not working, that's a real key motivating factor. And of course, we've seen this, Richard, in this last year. I mean, the kinds of medical care that people are getting is absolutely criminal. I was talking to a doctor, Dr. Hirschhorn, who's worked Boston Children's Hospital, and he agreed that, you know, what we're seeing here is just incredible medical malpractice. I think we're gonna see in the future, people are gonna look back at what has been done through this alleged pandemic. They're gonna look at this and they're going to say that's really not any different than the doctors who came up and used leeches on George Washington after he got a cold riding around his plantation and bled him to death.
I suspect the leeches are safer.
Yeah, that's right. They're probably not nearly as dangerous as one of these invasive ventilators, right?
That's right.
Let's talk a little bit about horticulture. You got involved in this, and you mentioned in your biography, Alan Chadwick, how he was inspirational to you in terms of off-the-grid organic type of stuff. Tell people a little bit about Alan Chadwick. I don't know a great deal about him. Perhaps the audience doesn't either.
Yeah, an amazing individual. There was a man that you may have heard of named Rudolf Steiner, after whom the Waldorf schools were started. And he had a long history of being in touch with nature and coming up with new means of what we would call organic gardening now, except it's known as biodynamic in the current systems. And there's a certification program that will go to your farm and certify you as biodynamic. It's kind of more in depth than just organic.
Because what is different with it than organic? Organic is there's so many different definitions for things. Organic means that they're not using chemicals for growing it, and maybe some other things. So what is the definition of organic and of biodynamic?
It's like so many things in semantics. It depends on who's using the term. Mm-hmm. You know, because I met Alan Chadwick when I was a university student in 1967. And he had been invited to the university to create what at that time we were calling an organic garden. long before there was an organic, national organic program with the government and all that. That's another long story. But Alan Chadwick was a direct student of Rudolf Steiner. He worked with him in Europe, in England, in Austria. Mm-hmm. And Alan was an interesting guy. He had been a naval commander on a warship in World War II. And he came from an aristocratic family and was a Shakespearean actor. And he dumped all of his high society connections and just decided he wanted to be a gardener and be in touch with nature. It was much more advanced than all the fancy stuff. And so he was the teacher that I ran into at the university who was really different than the academic teachers.
And so what did they do? How is biodiversity different from organic? How would you define those terms?
Well, biodynamic has a lot of specific things in it from Rudolf Steiner, certain ways of making organic fertilizers and stuffing them in a cow horn at a certain time of year and burying it in the ground for a certain amount of time. And amazing things happen with it that seem really magical. I would say that in general, rather than getting identified with a certain approach, it's just what's really behind the term, no matter whether you call it organic or biodynamic, is harmony with nature. And mm-hmm. It's something that's really missing from today's food production and everything else. I mean, it's one division of living in a giant mental hospital, which I think is what we're doing right now.
That's a good way to describe it. Yeah. One flew over the cuckoo's nest. It's medication time, and they've been ringing that bell for the last 700 and some odd days. You know, the medication is a genetic code injection. I talked to another individual who, again, because of he was a missionary to Romania, and while he was there, he got some radiation poisoning. And so he got very interested in organic food and that type of thing. Plus, when he was in Romania, the government was controlling, you know, there were shortages of things and you couldn't get them. And so the people who were eating were the ones who were doing the farming. And they were being left alone by the political class because the political class didn't want to starve either. So all of those things combined and got him interested in agriculture. And he even talked about doing hydroponics and aquaponics. And he said, yeah, the problem is when you taste the food, there's just nothing there. You know, he says it grows and it looks beautiful, but it's got, doesn't really have a taste because it's missing the minerals that are naturally there in the soil. And so when you're talking about biodynamic and organic, I mean, that's a big part of it. Going back to a simpler, more natural way of farming, and there are things that are there that we don't really understand, and that's why we're not replicating them in our technological imitations, right?
That's part of wisdom, I think, in general, in food production and everything else, is to realize that most of what's going on, we not only don't understand, we're not even aware of it. Mm-hmm. And the principles behind what's really organic farming and gardening is harmony with nature in a way that you don't have to micromanage everything. You just keep everything you're doing in harmony with the general principles, and nature and the spirit that's in it takes care of everything else, just like it's running our bodies. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have to be in charge that much.
I see. So you talk about how you were doing off the grid preparation, and tell us a little bit about what you're working on. I like to get Eric Peters on and talk about his new adventures into raising chickens and ducks as a newbie. A lot of us are newbies at all these different things because, you know, we've gotten to the point where we're used to all of our food coming wrapped in plastic at the grocery store. And we don't really know where it comes from or how we can replicate it. And we are so vulnerable to the system that has such long supply chains. And I believe that, as I've been saying with all this trucker stuff for the long time, I believe that the politicians are deliberately trying to throw everything they can right now into the supply chain to bust it. So how do we get some independence of that? Do you have some idea of what you would suggest to people who are just getting started in this, since you're much further down the road on this?
You know, in the beginning of America and many other places too, it was all farms, small businesses and independent farmers. And the farms were not monoculture farms. They were farms growing a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. And even with that situation, for example, in the 1929 depression in the U.S., the number of people who died from starvation would have been much higher, except for there were still some independent, diverse farmers. And I don't mean diverse racially, which they were. I mean diverse in what they grew. And so when I got in touch with Alan Chadwick, as a surprise when I was a university student, what we did is we met in this, what they called a chalet. It was a little cabin with no power or anything, and just had candlelight. And we would have lectures from him about nature, really inspiring, not the usual intellectual academic presentation, but somebody who was really in touch on a different level. But then we would go out and do it, you know, so it's not just theory. And we built this garden from nothing on a rocky hillside covered with poison oak, and it became the main attraction of the university. People would come from all over the world to see it, and by the way, stop and see the school too, but that wasn't nearly as interesting as the garden. And so, you know, there's so much to talk about here. When you're talking
describe
about
the garden a little bit to us. Describe the garden a little bit to us, because I get your point. You know, we've also we have these long supply chains, and everybody is hyper specialized, and so we also then have all these different transportation links in it, because you know, you do a little bit of something, and then the next part of the widget has to be added at this other place, so you have to transport it over there. And and your point being, excuse me, that they had a diversity of things that they were doing, not just raising one particular thing. But tell us a little bit about what that garden looked like, and how was it different?
I mean, it was spectacular. It was like, it's a challenge to put into words. When you step over the border of the regular land around it onto the garden itself, it was like you feel like you stepped into another world. And it was on a hillside. The university gave it to Alan to work on because they figured it wasn't good for anything, covered with rocks and poison oak and all that stuff, and quite steep. But it happened to be facing south, which was good for sunlight exposure. And so we dug the whole thing up by hand. There were no power tools involved at all. The university was gracious enough to pay for some shovels and a few things like that. So we dug it up and made long beds, what's called raised beds. And Alan became known for a system called the, it wasn't biodynamic. I'm thinking of the term that he used. It'll come back to me. Anyway, it's deep digging. It's all by hand, and you dig it up 2 feet deep and then move the soil and put it back in with nutrients in the form of manure. And we used wood ashes and mineral meal at that time that came from bones of dead animals, and we mixed all that into the garden. And the spectacular growth was, it was called biointensive by some people. And the amount of food that could be grown on a small area was spectacular. One of his famous students was named John Jevons, who wrote a book about how to do this at home. And that book may still be available on Amazon or somewhere.
And what is the name of that book? Do you remember? John Jevons.
I'm going back more than 50 years in memory. Yeah. It was something like how to produce more food than you can imagine on less area than you can calculate, or something like that.
That's good. How do you spell his? Do you remember how to spell his last name?
Yeah, it's Jevons, John. Okay. And he was doing that for a long time. He was a Stanford student who found out about Alan and was using it specifically as a method to overcome food shortages by growing huge amounts of food on a small area of land.
That's interesting. I think it's interesting, Richard, that you're saying that he did it on a hillside, because, you know, that's one of the things as we're looking in eastern Tennessee. A lot of people say, well, you know, you can't do anything with these hillsides. If you want to grow something, they typically want to have it on a flat area. And I assume that that's because they're going to use some agricultural tools to try to do it in a more massive way. But it's kind of interesting that he would do it on a hillside, that he would have these raised beds to do it, just taking it wherever it is. I think the key thing probably is what you're pointing out, the minerals that were added, the wood ash, the bones, and that type of thing. That's going to make that soil super rich.
Yeah. Manure is really good for soil, and the bone meal was too. Although there are other things now that I found out about since then. One of the primary sources of minerals for any garden is ground up rocks.
Really?
It's got various names, rock powder. There's a couple of sources. One ships out of California, somewhere around San Diego, and there's another one in the Midwest. And that's nature's way of remineralizing the soil, which occurs in cycles once every ice age. And it comes out of volcanoes and other places like that.
I was going to say, that's not something that you can do yourself, grinding up the rocks. But
no, you can't. Can. No, in fact, it seems to be the mineral content of the soil seems to be tied into the real climate change cycle, where you have ice ages interspersed with interglacial periods.
Right.
And during the ice age, the glaciers moving over the rocks grind them up. And then when they retreat, the dust blows all over the world and refertilizes the land.
That's very interesting. Yeah. Wow. That's great. So you're off the grid as well as doing organic farming where you are?
Not where I am now, but I've been involved in that a lot. I lived in Northern Idaho for a while off the grid and different places like that. And I am very involved in alternative energy technologies and looking at also, there's so many implications of this thing that you're talking about, for example, with survival food. What we learned with Alan and other people have discovered is that the main nutrient in food is not recognized by science. It's called life force. And when it's actually alive, like a leaf of lettuce or something is just bursting with life force. There's a type of photography that'll actually show it. Curlian, and there's some other ones. And when you cook it and boil it for a long time or chop it up and burn it and save it in a sealed container, the life force is almost completely missing. So this is a question with survival food issues, because when you buy survival food to last 25 years, there's a reason it lasts 25 years. You know, all of the life force in it that would break it down at the appropriate time is gone. So the question is, how do you do that with a food source that'll save a long time? And there are some alternatives.
Oh, yeah? That's good. Yeah. What do you do as an alternative then?
Well, for example, seeds, you know, have been found in old tombs and things like that, thousands of years old, and they still sprout. So what does that say, right? That says their life force is still there. So you can sprout edible seeds, and you don't even have to cook them. And they're a source of nutrients that is missing from the typical survival food.
That's interesting.
Nuts also store quite a while. Of course, that's a seed too. And they store a long time without refrigeration if they're in the shell.
Wow. You know,
it's a different way of looking at all these different foods.
Right. So seeds
honey
and nuts.
Also lasts thousands of years.
So seeds and nuts are a primary thing for you to save because of that. Anything else that you would mention?
There are a few things. Like honey saves several thousand years, which should be enough. You know, even if you have some of these things mixed with the typical idea of survival food, it really makes a difference in nutrient quality.
That's great. Oh, that's really interesting. So in terms of what people can do from a medical standpoint, what about medicinal herbs and things like that? Because as I was pointing out, you know, I saw the story from Michael Snyder saying, you know, we're getting so much of our medicine from China, they could just switch that off, or it could be switched off with the supply chain issues. You know, so there's two aspects of this. Number one is educating yourself to some natural alternatives to pharmaceuticals. And then I guess the other aspect of it would be what you could are there herbs and things like that that you could grow yourself?
You know what? I had to face all these issues in the 60s when I was really sick. And what I ended up coming to was really not an alternative to pharmaceuticals. I came up with an alternative, not me. I mean, lots of people have found it. A total alternative to the whole paradigm of drug medicine. You know, if you're doing drug medicine, this is a long topic, obviously, but it's all based on a symptomatic philosophy where things just happen and you don't know why. Maybe you ran into the wrong germ or you have the wrong genetics, or maybe things happen for no reason, which I've since found is totally never the case. And what the basic, see, when Pasteur was coming up with the germ theory, which he probably plagiarized from Beauchamp and some other people, there was an alternative theory to the germ theory, and that was called the terrain theory. And what that says is that we're infiltrated with microorganisms all the time. They're not the problem. If your body is called the terrain, is in the right condition, then all those microorganisms are there to keep you in balance and help you. Mm-hmm. And if you start getting filled up with toxic residues that come from a number of different important sources, and they start building up, the life forms in your body that are the microorganisms, they know their job, and they have to start breaking down the waste. But if it's in your body, that makes a mess, and it results in all kinds of degeneration and sickness. So if you change the condition of the terrain, then you don't care if you're around the microorganisms, they don't hurt you.
Well, that's very
true. It's a really different approach.
Yeah, yeah. When I ask you, you know, what kind of alternatives could you have? We're talking about really the same type of paradigm that the pharmaceutical companies have, and just substituting something that is natural for some kind of a synthetic drug. But as you're pointing out, perhaps a better paradigm is to try to get yourself as healthy as possible. And of course, we have seen that a great deal. They've even admitted that, well, you know, people who are healthier are not affected by this, but they are affected by the vaccine.
That's for sure.
That is designed
to disrupt.
Yeah, that's designed to disrupt your immune system, to disrupt your blood and all the rest of these things.
Right.
But
it goes with the question that you were talking about in the beginning, because if you eat non-organic food, as an example, what does that mean? They call it conventional in the store. When you see conventional, read poisoned. Mm-hmm. It's actually legal to spray poison on food and then eat it.
That's right.
That's absurd.
Yeah.
You know, the organic food is a bare minimum, and there's a lot more detail. So how you feed the body determines to a great extent what kind of toxic residue builds up. And that's a precursor to disease. So if you learn how to detoxify that stuff in certain ways that are not harmful, then you don't worry about the diseases anymore.
Yes, that's very true. Yeah, that's very important. When you look at what is happening right now, I mean, there's just so many at the center of this political tyranny that is running out there. Right. There is this conflict over health and medicine, and the fact that it's all going to be dictated to us by the corporations and that type of thing. So that's one aspect of it. The political aspect of it is ever present. And as I look at this, you know, I see good doctors who care about this, and they're looking at it from their paradigm, and they're trying to solve this problem from their paradigm, and they're surprised that the establishment doesn't want to hear the data that they've got or try any other alternatives, right? And so now they're gradually starting to wake up to the fact that politics is ruling everything, and that this is being forced and imposed upon them. And so I see these different doctors who have been a big part of this medical establishment starting to speak out and coming to this awakening. I mean, what do you think is going on right now, and are you optimistic or pessimistic? Will this be an awakening, or will this are we sleepwalking into a dystopian future because of the control of the press? How do you see this, Richard?
I don't necessarily think the short-term future is set. I think this is a showdown period between light and dark. And it's all based on consciousness, because if people were more awake, and, you know, that's a discussion of what that means. And I don't mean just memorizing a bunch of more accurate data. I mean, more self-aware. They would never fall for this kind of stuff. And that includes the people who are unknowingly serving the system, mm-hmm. because the system depends on a lot of willing servants that don't necessarily have bad motivation. And if they become more aware, the awakening that you're talking about, they'll stop serving it and it'll all fall apart. But what the outcome will be between the light and dark sides, I don't know. I just see that we have the potential to turn it all around, and it's all based on awakening to who we actually are. We're walking around playing parts that are not us, and that includes the bad guys.
That's very true. You know, I see that with these, when you have the dialogue between the truckers and the law enforcement officials who are there, And they're trying to reason with him and trying to get them to see the bigger picture, that they're a part of this bigger picture. And yet these police officers, the guy who just stepped down in Ottawa slowly, he comes back and says, no, this is what's going to happen. I'm here to deliver your message to, and this is what you're going to do because I said so, because my higher ups said so. They just see themselves as, widgets in this big machinery. And they think the big machinery is going to take care of them, but the big machinery just threw slowly himself under the treads and ran over him. And so I think a real key part of this is to see that they're connected to other people. I think the truckers see that, but certainly the police officers don't see that, right?
Yeah, if they wake up to who they are, they can't be hating anybody else, number one. They can't follow orders to hurt people. They can't follow suicidal orders like take this injection. They just can't do that because it goes against being true to themselves, and they feel discomfort whenever they divert from being true to who they really are. So this would all fall apart with awareness like that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. You have lostartsradio.com. Tell us a little bit about that.
My personal tendency and preference was to just be invisible and disappear indefinitely into the wilderness and live with nature and, not be involved in conflicts about anything. I think that the real state that we come from is so beautiful that it's more attractive to me than fighting in the world.
I think we all feel that way to some degree, said, oh, that I could have wings and fly away.
It's very appealing, especially in times like this. However, about 8 years ago, partly inspired by people like you that I was listening to from different sources, and partly because, well, actually, I have to be honest, I didn't really want to be public at all, but I was to be a guest on a show with a doctor named Rima Labo that you may have heard of. She was married to Stumblebine, the general.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Right. And I was on there talking about health. And there was another guest on that show at the same time, Dane Wigington. And he's an expert in geoengineering.
Yes.
And he was aware that I knew about geoengineering, a lot about it. And I'd studied it quite a bit in connection with all the weather stuff and everything. And he asked me to be a co-host. And it was right when I was planning to disappear. And I thought, all right, that must mean I should do it. So I was on that show for about 8 months. And then I was going to try again and disappear. And at the time, the owner of the network said, you really need to start a show on health because people don't understand how to apply this other paradigm that makes you not need the medical system, which I went through all the stages of that. And it really works. And so I said, okay, I'll do a show on health. And that's how Lost Arts Radio started. And then we got into that and started talking about what's violently suppressed in health in the U.S. and most of the world. And in the U.S., there have been about 200 and some doctors that have been murdered for daring to talk about what's wrong with vaccines and about what is right about things that make you independent. And so I decided we'd be talking about that and mainly lifestyle changes, because it turns out that little details in eating, what you eat, what in your sleep patterns and sunlight exposure and exercise and all these things are mainly what and your mental state and your emotional state are what really determine the health outcomes. So we're going to talk about that. And then quickly it turned out that you got all this theoretical stuff about, all right, just do this with your food, use fasting, all these things. And people ran into emotional blocks. And that's why we had to get into the area of consciousness.
Because they were getting too methodical about it, and it was...
They were using food as a way to feel happy and comfortable. Even if an hour later they felt bad, at the moment the dopamine hit from the taste was what they were attached to. And that's not the way to choose food if you want us to be healthy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I think that's a big part of the corporate food structure is to get you those hits.
It is.
And then you come back again and again.
The psychological part.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's saying that you're going to be happy.
Yeah. You get addicted to that. They got those certain triggers that are going to hit you with the sugar or whatever, or the salt. And then you're
exactly.
gonna, you like that. And so you're going to come back for that again. And all of a sudden you're eating all the time.
And it's very successful.
Yeah. That's very interesting.
And so I had to find a way to deal with mind, not brain, but mind, which is formless. Mm-hmm. And is where all the habits are stuck and where they're projected from. And I found out you can communicate. This is getting really outside the box. But you can communicate with mind in a way to drop habits. And it makes self-discipline almost completely unnecessary. And that became really interesting. And we went from there.
Well, that's interesting. Talk a little bit about geoengineering, because I just had a listener that called me out, said, you don't talk enough about geoengineering, always talking about climate change. And I do. I talk about the similarity between the way they've used fear and propaganda, how they have concealed data, how they've used bogus models and arguments from authority mm-hmm. and all these different types of things. But again, you know, at the same time, I'm aware of the geoengineering and the annual conferences that they have where they talk about, well, hey, the only problem is we got to figure out who gets to set the thermostat? You know, it's like at home, you know, the wife wants it warmer and you want it cooler. We got different yeah. countries that want different things. Tell us a little bit about geoengineering and where that is at the moment.
Well, I'm kind of an outcast from a lot of the geoengineering community because some of them feel that it's being used to cover up this imminent threat of global warming and climate change, and that we need to stop the geoengineering to see how bad the climate change is. And I'm saying, no, the geoengineering, it's a lot simpler than that. The geoengineering is to disturb the weather and ruin the normal weather patterns and intercept them, just like we watched them cause the California drought when I was on that radio show mm-hmm. on Radar. Mm-hmm. But it's much more than that. It's part of an extermination program that is much easier to just say, oh, that couldn't be possible. But one of the things I found out is that if you want solutions, you have to be really open to what the problem is. And geoengineering is about far more than weather. It's way more than engineering the so-called climate. I don't think they can affect the climate anyway, but they can sure mess up the weather. But they don't have to change the weather and engineer this climate change crisis through geoengineering, which they're doing, and then say it's terrifying. It's way more than that, because to do that, they don't have to poison the whole world. And they're clearly doing that. The ingredients are not just reflective metals.
What other things are they using? Because I've seen a lot about the reflective metals. What other things besides reflective metals are they using?
Well, there are some researchers like Carnicom and others that have torn apart some of the residue samples that they've gotten. And they've found biological organisms in there and what they call cross-domain bacteria and things like that, that are engineered to cause disease. And there are also different recipes being used in different places. And there are some people, for whatever reason, who have the ability to smell and taste which recipe they're using on a given day. And these are being changed all the time. I think it's clearly an extermination program. And they're also using aluminum, which is highly toxic in soils yes. and everything else. And there are places where the spray is making it impossible for the trees to live and things like that. That's not by mistake.
Yeah.
I see it as an extermination program.
I agree with you. I agree with you. I don't think, you know, we have Gates saying that he's going to release particles in the stratosphere in order to reflect sunlight and to cool the earth and that sort of thing. And that would be yeah. what the people in the first group are talking about. But I agree with you. I think it's more malicious than that. We can look at
you know, there was a guy.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
There was a scientist named Don Easterbrook who seems to have disappeared. I can't get a hold of him anymore. And he was pointing out in graphs that the sources that are being used to prove global warming are coming from UN-connected agencies that do what they call adjusting the data.
Mm-hmm.
That means they change the numbers to prove something.
Oh, yeah.
That doesn't exist. And that he showed with the real data that's not adjusted, in quotes, number one, there's no correlation at all between CO2 levels in the atmosphere and global temperature.
Yes.
nothing.
That's true.
That's a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, because they're saying that the reason we have to eliminate CO2, which Easterbrook also showed it as a low level right now in geological history. The reason they say we have to eliminate CO2 is because we're all boiling to death. But is this why some of the people who push this agenda buy mansions on the seashore? You know, it doesn't make a tremendous amount of sense.
That's right.
We're supposed to not notice anything wrong with that.
And we have seen an increase in CO2 without a predicted increase in temperature in the last few decades. And yet they persist with this. And of course, they are actively now talking about how they're going to take CO2 out of the atmosphere. I mean, you talk about some disturbing nature and the perfect cycle that is there, complementary CO2 between the plants and animals that is happening there, symbiotic relationship at the basis of that, and they want to try to take this natural substance that is vital to growing plants and vegetation. They want to remove that out of the atmosphere, and they're talking about very expensive and complicated procedures to try to store it in rock and to try to transport it across the country. It's going to be a massive amount of money made to do this. And if they are successful, it's going to have a lot of deleterious effects on us, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, if you want your greenhouse plants to be healthier now, one of the things you do is pump in extra CO2.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a bad thing at all. And they're talking about cutting down trees and burying them because the trees have carbon in them.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane. Well, I would like to get you back on and talk more in depth about geoengineering, because I think that's a very important topic that I haven't spent enough time on. I do talk about the climate stuff. I was involved early on with ClimateGate and with Michael Mann, who was trying to hide that data and insisted on hiding it, even though he had done it at a state university, had used it to make predictions and models that were used for political purposes. And we said, okay, fine. We'd like to see the supporting data. Of course, you can't see it anymore than you can get the data from Pfizer about their so-called tests. You know, they want to sequester that for 75 years if they get their way. So this is a clear sign of the fraud. It's a clear sign of an MO, because there's a lot of the same, you know, it's the same people behind both of these agendas. I call it a MacGuffin because it's kind of like what, you know, Hitchcock talked about in terms of a plot motivator. And so they've got different plot motivators. It could be global warming, global cooling. It could be a pandemic, but it's always to push you to the same lifestyle and the same society, dystopian society that they want. Doesn't matter what the cause, they always have the same end product that they want to enforce there. So
Right. And if you get people to understand how these pieces fit together in the bigger picture, then the next step is look for weak spots in the plan where it can be reversed.
Yeah,
that's important. And I think there definitely are some.
That's great. Yeah, we'll have you back on to talk about that. Thank you. Richard Sacks, and of course, the best place for people to find you is Lost Arts Radio. Is that it? .com?
LostArtsRadio.com, and you can stay up with where we're not being censored by LostArtsRadio.com/live.
Okay, great. Great. Thank you very much, Richard. It's great talking to you again. It's been a long time. And
nice to see you, David.
Got to get you back on to talk about geoengineering and some other things in more detail. All right, folks, going to take a quick
show anytime.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that, Richard. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. TheDavidKnightShow.com.